So welcome to the fourth and final presentation in this seminar series on the Manawatū heritage. Now our topic today is Te Manawa taking a bet on the future, and our two speakers are Cindy Lilburn and Karis Evans. Cindy Lilburn is the Collections Manager Heritage at Te Manawa, where she is fondly known as the Queen of the Collection for her extensive knowledge of Te Manawa's holdings. She's worked at Te Manawa Museum and subsequently the Manawatū Museum and subsequently Te Manawa for, I think, about 42 years, beginning as a volunteer in her last year as a student at NASI. She's also served as Chair of the Historic Places Manawatū Horowhenua and received the Palmerston North Heritage Trust Special Award in 2018 for her long-standing service to the preservation of the city and the region's heritage. She was, for example, a founding member of the Save the Region campaign, and you might remember in our last series we had a session on the region. By contrast, Wellington-born Karis Evans is a relative newcomer, having been appointed Heritage Curator at Te Manawa in April this year. However, she arrived with impressive academic credentials and a range of voluntary and professional experience, including a curatorial internship at the New Zealand Portrait Gallery, nearly 3 years as Art Centre Manager for the Fielding and District Art Society. Karis studied Classics and Anthropology at Victoria University, then curating at Sotheby's Institute of Art in London, before earning a first-class MA in curatorship from the University of Melbourne. Please welcome Cindy and Karis.
I think probably covers this part of the slides. I always like to check in the gods section of the balcony, are we able to hear me? That's good. I'll carry on. So although we're talking theoretically about 50 years to actually talk about the museum and to get an understanding of where collecting has come from, it's probably best to go back 120 years to the Palmerston North Philosophical Society Museum, which operated in this town from about 1906 to 1926. So it was established only 30 years after Palmerston North was founded, circa about 1870. And it was obviously considered a necessity by the locals in town, or at least a mark of progress. So by the 1900s, Palmerston North had risen to the point where it had churches, schools, a borough council, an opera house. And so this was a town that they obviously felt was firmly established and was on the rise. So the thing to note is that this institution collected curios, the exotic, as what you might call the ethnographic material, antiques and natural history. And the first collection had objects and specimens from all over the world, with no particular emphasis on anything local. So this is just to give you a feel for some of the first items in that collection. We have the original ledger, so that we've been able to track down some of those items and what they were. You can see there's quite a mixed bag. Fijian clubs, a piece of a shipwreck, a life preserver, a Dresden china plate. So these collections are actually very much in the style of the Victorian era, and I think the closest thing analogy is to think of the British Museum. And what they were aiming for was an encyclopedia of the world. And these sorts of encyclopedic museums aim to give you examples of each classification and each branch of knowledge, so an example of each one. And so this is so you could have comparison to show the wide varieties of culture, which was generally showing that progression from primitive cultures to advanced, brackets, white cultures. And in the case of natural history and geology, it was sort of like looking at what natural resources were available. So in New Zealand, the first museums were established from about the 1850s onwards. Pretty close after, you have the settlement of Auckland, Canterbury and Otago, followed a little bit afterwards by Wellington. And as an example of the style today, if you go to Dunedin, there is an Otago Museum and an Otago Settlers Museum, or Toi Tu, they call it now. So the Otago Museum was founded in 1868, and it's an encyclopedic museum. It's got natural history, the Maori and the multicultural material, and antiques. Whereas if you go across the Settlers Museum, which was founded in 1906, it's got the region's colonial past preserved in that space. There's very few colonial items, as you'll see in that first museum, because, of course, they were still living in that era. They did have a few talks about colonial, but they were talking about 1840s and 1830s as far as they were concerned. So rather, the European items we have in this collection were trying to reflect the refinements of the homelands that people had come from. So the antiques and the fine arts and the decorative arts. Then we hit the 1970s, 1960s, and you have a wave of a second phase of museums, which happened as in many places, particularly more inland places like Hamilton, Rotorua and ourselves, reached their centennials. And so you have the rise of many of these pioneer museums, pioneer cottages, and pioneer villages. And each of those tried to house colonial items in their spaces. And we were near the tail end of this wave. Our centennial was in 1970. And it's to be remembered that the last of Palmerston's real early settlers had actually shuffled off this mortal coil in about the 1930s. They did have several times they had photographs of early settlers in 27 and 36, but after that it was just not feasible. So, once you hit that centennial, people started talking about having another museum. And it was driven initially by the Palmerston North Polynesian Discussion Group, which was founded in 1955. Great devotees of the Journal of the Polynesian Society, and they had a particular interest in the former Palmerston North Philosophical Society Museum collection. Some of it had been saved and had been stored by the council at their depot, so there's potential to revive. It was mostly middle-aged white men, a few Maori from our community, and as Minor McKenzie, our former director, used to comment, the women were there to make the tea. So together with that, and something called the Manawatu Museum Planning Society, one of whom was Ian Matheson, well known to you as the local archivist, got together in 1967 to start gathering a collection, and they were working towards a proper museum with 20,000 square feet of space, so quite a large museum. But with the city centennial looming, and I guess money, it got diverted into a temporary museum at 15 Amesbury Street, and a historic cottage, which is Totoranui, which was placed in the square. It was a bequest to the city. So here's Totoranui in the square. This building has waltzed now through about five different moves, but this is its second move, first move, and this is on the corner of the square and Main Street West, which is approximately where the City Council's Customer Service Centre is now. And on the right, that's an image showing the Totoranui kitchen display in the early 70s. So it's, as you can see, a little overcrowded with stuff. The items are there because there's no storage, and there's what we call in the trade not a lot of interpretation to tell you what it is that you're looking at. It's just a real melange or mixture of kitchen things laid out for you to admire. So this is the other building, which was the Museum at Amesbury Street, which still stands in the Catholic properties. and it was more a sort of interpretive space. And so we have a catalogue of the first displays in 1971. So that catalogue says that they tried to have something that showed the past, the present and the future. So that was photographs and maps. And for the future, they had plans for the empty railway land. They had something to show the landscape and geology of this area. They had a display about conservation, erosion and water use. The Maori people on the left, and dairying as one of the industries. And they promised that they were going to go on and look at some of the other industries. Sheep farming, cropping, flax milling, sawmilling. Oh, transport and communications. We are, after all, a railway hub. Local geology, botany and zoology, and fashion. Just because they'd obviously been, as you can see, gifted a lot of the same. So, collecting is easy. Professor Keith Thompson was one of our early planning committee people, and as he commented, it's not difficult to acquire material. People give you things that they no longer want, or you inherit it, or you scavenge it, or you even buy it. And so some of our philosophies of the time was that we take it now, as we might not be offered it again, and we can sort out any duplication problems later. How many flat irons? We'll worry about the number of flat irons a bit later. Our procedure was to sign over ownership on the spot, in case we never saw the donor again, and in some cases they literally told us they were on their way to the dump. So that was quite true. There was minimal research into the object's history, and so I'm cursed with things, records that say, came from my grandmother. Yes, very helpful for putting it into context. Might it be useful for education? Now, our committee, our very first committee, many of those were professional educators, and they believe that one of the good things about museums is it's important for children to experience or to see natural cultural objects at first hand. There's nothing to beat the real thing. And so we did acquire a lot of multicultural material for comparison with Pākehā and Māori culture, and so we hold collections from Samoa, a small collection from Aboriginal Australia, and something called the New Tribes Mission, which was a missionary school that actually functioned out at Tangimoana. But you can just see that behind this, there might have just been the inkling of that idea of working towards being one of those encyclopedic museums, rather than it sort of being strongly Manawatū. The other aspect is something that we call passive collecting, which is that you get what people choose to give you. And so things have been pre-sorted by the time they come to you. So they come from people who are accustomed to the idea of what a museum is and think it's a place that's a good place to lodge things. They think it should be significant enough to be in a museum. They think the museum should take it because, look, they're downsizing or they're clearing out an estate. And perhaps, you know, the museum might want it. Many of those colonial objects came in to tell the stories of those hard-working pioneers, men and women, who overcame their obstacles and made a success of their life on this new land. We don't hear very much about those who went bankrupt and snuck off back home. and in the 1970s, it reflects the life of the majority. There was sort of that minimal discussions as of minorities as we might think of them today. I think there's that sort of aspect that we're all sort of, you know, New Zealanders are all one people together, so you don't look at, don't have items which reflect the gay, Maori community, people who are poor or from ethnic communities such as the Chinese or Indian community here in town. So, to a degree, our collecting that we've been doing up to this point has sort of been, I wouldn't say blinkered, but narrowed. So our theme in the 1970s was Manawatū and its peoples. And there is such a thing in the trade as what's known as a collections policy or collecting policy. And these are sort of philosophical documents that are entitled try to make you think about the parameters of what you collect, or in fact try and, like a thesis, try and make sure you don't stray too far off into unnecessary things. And so in 1975 we moved to Church Street into a brick warehouse, and our collecting policy at that point was sort of narrowing down to being Manawatu and Horowhenua. And we still have that a little bit. We might collect across from Woodville or across to Bulls. So we moved to Church Street, and among our properties, as well as the warehouse that we turned into the display area, we had the historic cottage, Totorunui, uplifted itself again for its second time. We had a replica of Snelson's store, George Snelson being one of our very first shopkeepers in town. We had a smithy or a forge. We had the Arahouse South schoolhouse that we actually went out and purchased. But, you know, we're starting to go slip from the Encyclopaedic Museum into being possibly just a pioneer village here. And if we'd acquired a few more buildings, we might have gone that way. I was always on a new museum building, and unfortunately, as I know from working for historic places, if it's an old historic building and it's empty, people go, we can put a museum in that. but before we got to where we are now, which is the Isa building, a converted government block of offices from the 50s, before we got to that, we had several options. We had Acacia Birch, with the proposal for putting a pioneer village at the back, which would have been quite tight. We had the option of the Commercial Travellers Club, which is now Arana Tamariki, which came with an industrial-sized beer tank underneath its floor, which would have made catering a lot more easy. And we did get offered the Longburn Freezing Works, because it's an empty historic building. And we used to joke that we could beat that infamous museum fatigue, which is, you know, we have to walk around and sore feet. We could just hook our visitors up to the chain. And, you know, they could just gently trundle past the exhibits. So we moved into our new space in February 1994, and I can recall standing there among all that empty shelving, just waiting for things to, waiting to move ourselves in and thinking just how much space we had. I think we had about 20,000 objects then, which I think is helpful because we'll be talking about the amounts we've been taking in, and we're now up to about 45. So, after 20 years, the Manawatu Museum now became a city institution, and because there was a sniff of a new museum, we started ramping up the collecting activity, and you can see, as we said, 20,000, we're getting about 1,500 objects a year, so maybe a little under 10% increase per year being offered to us over those couple of years. And this is the point at which I leave, and I now put Karis to speak about
what happens after.
What happens after.
Thank you, Cindy. Right, so after the drama of the big surge, those at Tumanawa figured out that hoarding was quite easy, but collecting really was quite difficult. With the new building a reality, the institution which was starting to, which was moving towards what we now know as Tumanawa, really had to think seriously about how to control the flow of objects coming through its doors. Even though it started off with plenty of space to fill, the reality was that that space was finite. Some of the major changes that took place in the early 2000s through to the 2010s was a new policy against long-term and indefinite loans. A lot of objects in the collection had been offered to the museum for safekeeping, but they were still owned by the people that had made that gift. They could be taken back at any time. Some of them might have conditions on how they can be used or where they could be displayed, that sort of thing. And of course, if the museum wanted to dispose of them, they couldn't. As well as returning some of those loaned objects, in 2013 there was a cull, asking lenders, if not taking them back, to formally gift some of those objects to the collection. And the museum started looking at more formal collections policy. This wasn't just a guiding statement anymore. It was a document that included some ethical and strategic considerations about how the collection should be looked after and what should be coming into the museum. Those new policies were supported by new procedures about how accessions are made, i.e. how objects are taken in, and what happens if we want to deaccession an object through removal or disposal from the collection, which does happen from time to time. With all of those sorts of changes, over those few years, we went from having 1,500 objects coming into the collection every year to only about 100. That number might fluctuate only if an object came in that had lots of individual parts that needed to be catalogued separately. With these sorts of changes, the idea that less is more started to permeate the museum. And so with those ideas percolating, we arrive at 2024. With the remainder of this presentation, what I'll be doing is introducing some of the ideals that guide the way that we collect today, in contrast perhaps to how the museum collection started off. Firstly, collecting for a museum in 2024 is very different to collecting in 1974. Today, we want to ensure that all of the communities in our region can enjoy, engage with, and benefit from the collection. To that end, our whole museum, including the collection, is governed by an overall vision. At the moment, our vision is to plant the seeds of tomorrow through the stories that we share. And so even though our heritage collection is primarily concerned with the past, what the vision statement asks us to do is encourages us to think about how our collection can shape the future. Sitting below our overall vision is the collections policy. Quite different to some of the policies of the past, this is quite a large document. But the key goals are about making sure the items we collect help us to plant those seeds of tomorrow by collecting objects that have a real connection to our region, that are made here or relate to the people that have made a difference to our community. By following the policy, what we hope to do is help people develop and reproduce collective identities about what it means to be part of the Manawatū, to ensure that our visitors, when they come into the museum or access the collection, feel that they understand where they come from or how they fit into the place that we call home. We also want to inspire a sense of local pride and encourage our future innovators. And underpinning those ambitions are a whole series of guidelines and processes. So if you were to walk into Te Manawa today with an object that you thought was valuable to the collection, we would be unlikely to take it, in great contrast to what might have happened 50 years ago. Instead, your offer would trigger a whole series of processes. That would include an assessment by what we call our Collections Development Committee, which is a group of staff from across the organisation. Your offer would be assigned to a curator like me, who would start to develop a proposal, which is an intense research process that might involve interviews, photographing, measuring the object, collecting information not just from you, but other people who might know about the object, understanding what similar objects exist in other collections, and that sort of thing. When that proposal is all brought together, it then goes to a collections committee, and from there up to our board. So it can take months from the date in which your offer is made to its actual formal acquisition into the collection. Now, that can be cumbersome at times, but what the slow process enables us to do is ensure that we understand for whom this object is important, what it tells us about our local people, our place and our identity. Can it be exhibited? How much space do we need to store it amid these rapidly filling shelves? Is it damaged? If it is damaged, is it something that we can fix? Do we have enough staff to care for this object? If we don't, how much would it cost to hire other people to help look after this new material that's coming in? Each of these questions is really important to ask as part of our processes, because we recognise that we cannot collect everything. We certainly cannot collect everything at the pace that was happening in the 1990s, for instance, because our storage space is finite and the number of staff available to care for every object is limited as well. We cannot assume that we are going to get more people or more space. So we must assume that for every square centimetre, every minute of time that an object that is invested in any object, it's something that can't go into, that's time and personnel that can't be invested in something else. And that's something that we have to be really strategic about. Now, Tumanawa isn't the only museum grappling with these sorts of challenges and questions. When we're asking why we collect, who it's for, and considering our space and time needs, we're doing what a lot of museums around the world are doing. And many of us are guided by the ICOM Code of Ethics when trying to grapple with some of these questions. ICOM is the International Council of Museums, and it was established in 1946. It's a global membership organisation that helps develop professional and ethical best practice for museums. It has 129 branches, including in Aotearoa, and while it's not compulsory to be a member of ICOM, Tumanawa isn't, the resources that they produce do guide the way that museums all over the world conduct their collecting. One of their codes is the Code of Ethics, which deals with a whole gamut of museum operations. But relevant to collecting is principle number 2. It is that museums have the duty to acquire, preserve, and promote their collections as a contribution to safeguarding the natural, cultural, and scientific heritage. Their collections are a significant public inheritance and have a special position in law. They are inherent in them is public trust and the notion of stewardship that includes rightful ownership, permanence, documentation, accessibility, and responsible disposal. So as I said, we are not a member of ICOM, but all the ideals that are represented in this international code of ethics are also reflected in the way that we're going about our own collection strategies. So with that as a bit of background as to how and why we acquire objects in 2024, let's have a look at what we currently have. So Cindy's provided a summary of the key developments in Tumanawa's history and introduced us to some of the interesting objects that date back to those early days of collecting. But after almost 50 years, what do we have? First of all, more than 45,000 objects. This is not a remarkable number compared to other regional museums. We're on par, but it is quite a large number of objects given the age of our museum. We have our storage spread across 2 heritage collection stores and a warehouse area, all on our site just across the road. These objects and the space they take up is in addition to the art collection, and at the moment we have just about run out of room. Now, despite the size of our collection, our focus is quite narrow, as Cindy has alluded to. So most of the objects in the collection, as in the 1990s, relate to the experiences of Pākehā people between 1900 and 1970. And that's not inherently a bad thing. It's just reflective of the age and experience of the people who have shaped the collection over time, whether that be our donors, past curators or the interests of directors. Now, within our collection, there are some areas that are strong. And by that, I mean these are areas of the collection that are comprehensive. They cover a range of styles, makers, and time periods. They are well-researched and have a strong connection to the Manawa too, with great exhibition potential. Some of these strong collection areas might not be what you would expect to find in a museum. There are things like beautiful clothes from the 1950s, we've got children's toys, and then perhaps this might be what some people expect to find in the museum, and yet we've got lots of them more. So. Things that are within living memory and have that sort of nostalgia factor to them. Now, weaker areas in the collection are those that need more development through what we call proactive acquisition activity. When we talk about proactive collecting, we're basically saying we're going to go out and look for it. In a recent assessment of our collection, some of the areas of weakness that we identified are that we don't have a lot of material that reflects the diversity of our region. A lot of the objects predate the 1970s. We need some more objects that relate to prominent individuals and what they've contributed to our region, as well as local businesses and innovation. We also have the challenge of, like Cindy mentioned, objects just being from someone's grandmother. And what does that mean? There are about 20% of our objects where really we don't know much about where they came from, and lots of our material is mass-produced. Now, some of these weaknesses are easier to address than others. For instance, objects from post-1970 may be able to be purchased on the open market quite easily. But to address things like diversity, we need to build relationships with communities who might not have engaged with us before. Some of these groups may not see the museum as a space that's for them or as a space that they can trust with their important historical material. So we have to convince these groups through relationship building that the museum is a safe and appropriate space for their cultural material to live and be cared for in perpetuity for the benefit of future generations. So, as we work to address the weaknesses and gaps in our collection, we are looking to reflect the communities that have shaped the museum over time. We want to ensure that the collection is as diverse as the region in which it exists. Ideally, it would include objects produced in a range of different contexts, by different cultural groups, by different people. A hand-knitted scarf, a couture dress, and a mass-produced t-shirt, for instance, could all make great additions to the collection. We just have to ensure that they are clearly connected to the identity and the culture of the Manawa too. Each item that we collect should go some way in helping us understand our culture and the identity of our region, the achievements of our people, or innovations that have been developed here. We emphasise local connections because we want to situate our collection within a wider picture of distributed national collections. What I mean when I say that is, for example, Te Manawa does not have a large collection of objects relating to the 1981 Springbok tour, for instance. It's a nationally significant event, but we would be unlikely to collect it. We know that the Rugby Museum has a great collection of objects that capture the protests and expert knowledge to interpret that material authoritatively. If we were collecting protest material, we would probably focus our efforts on something like the Longburn Freezing Works. The establishment of the freezing works in the 1890s, the employment relation issues that emerged in the 1970s, and the works' subsequent closure all had a major impact on the Manawa Tu economy. The development of the facility is closely interconnected with the development of railway in and out of Palmerston North, and later the works were a major employer of Māori and women. But the works and the protests that ruptured in 1970 over pay are not well recorded by institutions outside of Palmerston North, nor are they likely to be because of their specific link to our location. So that's the type of area where Te Manawa would be the local logical custodian of any associated objects. But before we go off and collect every boot and knife we can from the Longburn Freezing Works, how do we know that this is a topic worth collecting? As a curator of heritage, I do not get to decide what does or does not qualify as important history. Instead, we make this assessment by understanding an object's significance. Now, when we talk about significance in the context of a museum, we use a framework called Significance 2.0. It outlines four ways in which an object might be deemed important to a museum. Two of these are relevant to understanding heritage objects. They are historical significance, which means that material is associated with a particular person, group, event, place, or activity. It uncovers a historical theme or a pattern of life. By collecting an object that has historical significance, we are developing an understanding of a particular way of being at a certain point in time. When we're thinking about historical significance, we're often looking to research and researchers, Massey academics, for instance, or other curators, as well as non-professional historians to help us uncover hidden stories that might have been lost to the past. Social or spiritual significance, on the other hand, relates to contemporary concerns. If the museum were to look at an object within that framework, we would be considering that it has value to a community today. That it may have historical significance as well, but that's been carried through into the way that we live our lives currently. It might embody a particular belief, idea, custom, tradition, or practice that is important to one specific area of the community. In addition to those criteria, there are other factors that can help us decide if an object is important for the collection. That is its provenance, i.e. where it came from, its rarity or representativeness, so is it the last remaining one on Earth, or were there lots of them, and it helps us understand a practice of everyday life. Its conditional completeness and its interpretive capacity, i.e. can it be exhibited. Now, when we're dealing with spiritual or social significance, what we do is typically consult with community groups and other knowledge holders. With that type of significance, lived experience is key. And now this becomes especially important when we think about contemporary collecting. For instance, one might think that an object, or collecting an object from 2022 would be a tough case to make for the heritage collection, given that primarily we work in the realm of history. But if we use tools like Significance 2.0, we don't need historical distance to tell us that something is important. If we can link back to moments in time or people for whom an object is important, we can demonstrate that these types of objects can belong in the museum. As an example of this, I'd like to introduce you to one of the latest additions to the Heritage Collection that might come as a little bit of a surprise. The entire Paku toy range was accessioned into the Te Manawa Heritage Collection in 2024. They represent a first go at filling some of the gaps we know exist in our collection, and they've been a bit of a test run for shaping the way that collecting might go from 2024 onwards. Paku's toy range includes a toki and a timo. They are gardening tools designed and manufactured. Sorry, they are toys inspired by gardening tools manufactured by Wellington-based company Paku from 2021 onwards. The company is owned and operated by James Pryor and Dr. Johnson Witihira. The two designers are concerned with using contemporary design principles and sustainable materials developed using new technology to create bicultural objects that connect today's activity with knowledge practices of the past. The gardening toys are produced both in Wellington and in Fielding. The tools on which they are based share the same name, and even though these are marketed as toys, they can also be used for their traditional functions, like chopping stumps, digging holes for kumite pits, and that sort of thing. During the prototyping process, the robustness of the design was tested at the Hapaiata Kohangareo in Fielding. And as well as being excellent toys, what the designers found was that they fit within a wider movement of Mātauranga Māori revival. By having children play with them today, they are connecting back to pre-colonial ways of being and living and experiencing the world. The paku toys are reimagined objects, which are associated with the past but have renewed relevance for children of today. Can you still hear me? Now, why did we choose these objects to come into the heritage collection? Last year, our museum society started undertaking some research into the collection, and their focus was childhood stories. As well as uncovering the gaps that we've already addressed, they found that one of the notable absences for toys and games in particular in the Te Manawa collection was that there wasn't really a way of exhibiting these materials in a way that showed Māori or other non-Pākehā experiences of being a child. That absence is now formally acknowledged in our collection strategy and is something that we go out and proactively collect. But no such list existed at Te Manawa at the time. So one of our senior collection staffers had suggested paku as objects that would be a suitable first step to proactively fill that gap and initiate the practice of contemporary collecting, i.e. collecting the now, understanding that it might be the history of the future. And from what we can say from today, she was right. After a lot of research and the production of an 8-page document to demonstrate why these materials were a great acquisition, they did finally arrive in the collection. I will not go through the entire 8-page document with you, but to demonstrate the ways in which our collections policy and the significance 2.0 sort of logic is applied, we can summarise why these were deemed significant. We decided that the paku toys has social significance. Because they were used in Kohangareo in Fielding, they connected children of today with knowledge that had been handed down from the past. So Toki and Timor are in and of themselves important historical objects. The fact that these are new interpretations of them gives them social significance to a different group of people, but as part of a whole lineage that takes them back over 100 years, 150 years. The provenance was really strong. These have not been left by someone's grandmother. They had a clear link to the Manawatū through their use at the Kohangareo and through their production and fielding. Even though these are mass-produced objects, we can consider that they're rare. There aren't many examples today of Mātauranga Māori revival being pursued through design, technology and play for children. They also have great interpretive capacity. The paku toys strengthen an existing collection in terms of our childhood toys, and they would fit well with a display on that topic. They might also fit into other displays around gardening tools, for instance. And through their maker, they have a strong connection to the Massey design program. So that's just one example of how we have been collecting for today. And to sum up, what I can really say is that developing a museum collection really is like taking a bet on the future. Since Te Manawa started collecting in the 1970s, lots has changed, not just in the way that our museum works, but in the way that all museums undertake their collecting activity. There is so much stuff to be collected, and at first, our museum was in a hurry to gather that up, as much of it as we could. But as concepts like museum ethics have been developed, our organisation's priorities have been refined, and we've come to take a more conservative, slow and considered approach to the way that we develop our collection. Thankfully, there are plenty of tools to help us assess what we should or should not collect as we try to build our collection despite limited space, time and staff. Knowing where our gaps are means that we can work with our communities to start to target specific time periods and develop our collection strategically so that it has greater meaning going forwards. We hope that as we build our collection, the aspects of our practice that we're applying now will contribute to the development of a collection that our region can be proud of. Hopefully, our bet pays off, but ultimately, we just don't know. So, as we head towards the break, I'd just like to introduce you to a little exercise. As well as writing down your questions as you ordinarily would, do have a think about whether you would collect this object. Given what we've discussed about some of the challenges that we've faced at Te Manawa and how we collect now, think about whether you would collect this classic PlayStation that was gifted to the museum for education. It was found in a storeroom sometime later, but it's in excellent condition. It comes in its box with instructions and everything. It's iconic technology that people of a certain age definitely played on and will remember, but we don't exactly know where it came from. So what I will do is leave that up on the slide, and if you don't have any questions to ask during the break, maybe give your views or pose some counter questions about whether you think this would make a good idea, a good addition to the Te Manawa collection. It is, after all, sitting in a storeroom already on site. Should we take it on? But otherwise, thank you very much for having both Cindy and I. It's great to introduce what we do and what we've been doing. Thank you.